Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is one-star general Amanda Reyes. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, one star. I got to work harder to get that second star, don't I?
Well, that's, see, last time you were a colonel, so I'm promoting you every time, and I specifically wanted to say one star, because then when next year, two star, like, well, you'll build up to that. So that's why I wanted to make sure I got that in
there. I didn't realize I've been promoted. I'm so excited. And I'm excited about the VIP tent, because they could have used the VIP tent in the episode you're going to be talking about.
They sure could have. Yes, we're here to talk about the season 5, episode 5, The Nurses. The original air date was October 19th, 1976, written by Linda Bloodworth and directed by Joan Darling. Remember that name, everybody. Of course, Amanda, you've been on the show multiple times, so we can get right into the plot synopsis. With temperatures rising outside and inside the 477th, an argument breaks out between the nurses and Margaret. It gets uglier that night in the nurses' tent, spilling into a brief spat of violence between Margaret and Nurse Baker, ending with Margaret confining Baker to quarters for the duration. Unfortunately, right after that, Baker's new husband, a GI named Tony, arrives in camp to visit his new wife. They haven't even had a chance to have a honeymoon yet. Hawkeye and BJ have the meet in the swamp, and they take it upon themselves to give the two a night together, Margaret be damned. They contrive a story about Tony having the plague and needing to be quarantined for 24 hours in Margaret's tent. Colonel Potter is suspicious, but Hawkeye and BJ bluff their way through it successfully enough for Potter to agree to the quarantining for now. Margaret is piping mad and gets madder still when Potter tells Margaret that she has to spend the night in the nurse's tent. Unfortunately, the next part of their plan was to have Frank try and romance Margaret in the swamp, giving Baker the chance to sneak out. But when Frank refuses, out of some sense of misplaced pride, Hawkeye and BJ realize they've crapped out. Margaret bunks down with the nurses, but Baker tries to slip out anyway. She manages to get out and spend the night with her husband as planned. But just as she crawls back into her own bed, Margaret is there awake, waiting for her. The next morning, this leads to a confrontation, and Baker reveals what she was doing and how the whole thing was a sham. Margaret is enraged, but breaks down when she reveals that part of the reason she's so hard on the nurses is because she's always felt ostracized by them. They've never invited her to talk or even offered her a lousy cup of coffee. The nurses are stunned into silence. Margaret storms out, headed to the OR to take care of incoming wounded. Colonel Potter demands to know what happened to the soldier who supposedly had typhoid, and when Hawkeye and BJ give a hastily thought out, clearly BS answer, he calls their bluff. He tells Margaret that they've been the victim of some trickery, and if she wants to press charges, he'll understand. Margaret takes a long look at her nurses and refuses, saying it's a matter between her and them. Potter accepts this, and they go to work. Later, the nurses are back in their tent, winding down. Margaret comes in with the next day's assignments, but instead of it being another confrontation, they offer her a lousy cup of coffee, which Margaret gently accepts. All right, Amanda. I mean, I don't know anyone that doesn't love this episode. This is just a universal classic show featuring, you know, the nurses never really got a whole lot of play on the show, other than, you know, the one episode with Nurse Kelly later on in season 11. But here it really focuses on Margaret and her relationship with the nurse in the set. We're going to go through the scenes, but overall, what's your feeling about this episode?
Oh my God, I love this episode so much. So I would have been too little at the time that this originally aired to really understand the episode, but we watched this show in reruns throughout my entire childhood. It was just on TV constantly. And I can remember being a young kid and watching this, probably 10, and being really struck by it. I could verbalize then what I was feeling, but, you know, through the years, Loretta Swit and Margaret Houlihan have become very important to me as a woman, because A, Loretta Swit's amazing, but B, the character arc she has on the show is just stunning. It's stunning. And to be the only woman on the show and to have this really fabulous arc, better, I think, and more complete than anybody else on the show, means a lot to me. And also the fact that I think Loretta Swit was a little bit older when she hit fame, and this kind of second chapter of her life is just full of like this kind of stunning work, you know, in here and in the TV movie as well. And And so I feel very close to this episode. Not that I watch it all the time or anything, but when it does come on, and I watched it twice for this, over the course of 2 days to really kind of soak it up. And it's just an amazing episode. I don't know what else to say. I made very little notes because it's sometimes when things are so good, you're like, I don't know what to say. It's just amazing. And so, but mostly it's that I like the growth that Margaret goes through. And this for me is the real turning point. And if not the turning point, then it's like the high point of Loretta Swit's sort of career on the show in terms of like just phenomenal. Let me just own this. And nobody else can come even close to her shining star in this episode. So yeah, it's fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, we've talked about across season 4 and then even the first couple episodes of season 5 is that Loretta Swit did not get to appear in a lot of the really transcendent episodes of season 4 because she was off on Broadway doing plays and stuff. And so they, you know, very kindly wrote her out of the show. It wasn't like they forced her to say, pick a side. They let her go off and do these things. And so, but on the downside, she got to miss out on, you know, the interview, you know, I mean, she got to miss out on some really, you know, The More I See You, which of course you and I talked about last year, she got to miss out on some important shows. So it feels like for season 5, they were like, okay, let's, as you say, of all the characters, she gets the greatest arc in terms of where she starts the show season 1 and where she ends it. But season 5, especially, they just gave her so much good material to chew on. And as you said, like Loretta Swit was like a little older. You know, it wasn't like she was like 22 and all of this was new. It was, she was, you know, she had some experience and was able, I think really was like, okay, I'm just going to grab this with both hands and really make a meal out of it. And in big and small ways, I talked about in the first episode of this season, Bug Out, where at the end of that episode, when everybody comes back to the 477th after having bugged out, and Hawkeye boosts Margaret onto the back of Colonel Potter's horse. And there's that wonderful sequence where she's just got her arms around him as he's directing traffic and telling Jeep, go here, you go here. And it's like a big, you know, it's a small thing. There's no dialogue, but it's a big moment. You're like, wow, she's not part of the, you know, the them group, which is her and Frank anymore. She's kind of on board with what's going on now. She loves this new commander and she's forming a relationship with him. And that's a small thing. And then in the very next episode, she gets engaged to Penobscot, which of course is going to be a huge deal for her character. And then just a couple shows later, she gets this. So, I mean, they were just serving her up the best possible material. And of course, you know, as I mentioned, this episode was written by Linda Bloodworth, who had done previous episodes and went on to create Designing Women and did a lot of other stuff in television. So you can imagine that they, you know, Linda Bloodworth's previous episodes were Margaret centric. So in some ways it's like, okay, Linda Bloodworth kind of almost knew, I know how to write this character and really present her, you know, show sides of her that we would never get to see. And after this, as you said, you can't see Margaret the same way after this. You just can't because of the relationship she has. And again, we're going to get into the specific scene. So the show opens with the OR sequence where, as they've suggested, it is blazing hot out and everybody is sweating. And we see they've really done a nice job of everybody's got like that big pool of sweat, like right under their neck kind of thing. And even the way it's lit, it has a kind of like hazy feel to it. And you almost can like feel how hot it is in here. And you got to think, how uncomfortable is this that you've already, you know, you're dealing with blood and guts and yet on top of it, it's like 102 degrees. It's like, it to me, you really feel it. And the way they light the windows through the shades where you just like, it's blazing hot out and you cannot escape it. So everybody's tense and mad. And of course the nurses cannot help but criticize Frank, because of course Frank is the worst doctor in the world. And Margaret can't allow that. She just cannot allow that to go on. And even when the one nurse really mouths off in front of Frank, she's got to criticize him because okay, Margaret's got to, you know, she's got to keep a tight rein on these nurses, even though we all know, you know, Frank's being Frank.
Yeah. You know, it's such a good scene and I really do like the interplay between everybody, but when I watch this, I do think, God, Frank's awful. And there's that great scene where they talk about having a hot flash, and I can't remember how Frank responds to it, but like it's a disease. Mm-hmm. And the nurse says it's just a symptom, and And I, you know, you never hear talk like that even now on TV, even referencing hot flashes and menopause and like the stuff that, you know what I mean? And so to have it like casually thrown in there and then have something snarky come back and then for her to normalize it was really interesting, even though I know it doesn't have anything to do with the main story, but I appreciated like where she would get fed up with him because he doesn't care about anything. You know, he has no sensitivity and he's awful at what he does. He didn't even ask for the right instrument. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, and then when she calls him Mr., I just love it. That's one of those moments where like, I'm quietly cheering as much as I love Frank Burns because I love Larry Linville, you know, he's almost like a love to hate him, not J.R. Ewing love to hate, but like, he's fun to watch, but you wouldn't want to know him at all in real life.
You know? Yeah. I like that you said you mentioned the thing about the mister. I love the way that was directed again by Joan Darling, in that they kind of overlap. She calls him mister instead of doctor, and he's like, that's Dr. Burns. And they almost talk over each other, which feels very real.
Yeah.
Because everybody is just at their limit. And it doesn't feel like actors waiting for the other actor to stop talking so they could talk. It feels genuine. Like that's how an argument could be, where two people are starting to kind of yell over each other. And of course, Margaret jumps in and then punishes her and says, basically just for that, you're going to clean up the OR after. And the nurse kind of says, you know, yes, Major. Cause she realizes, all right, this is going too far. But yeah, it's, you know, and then of course Potter gets so frustrated. He says, everybody just calm down. Cause he's just like, all right, I've had enough of this. But yeah, it's really, sets the scene up sets the stage for the episode really effectively.
Yeah, it's a really interesting episode because there's a really naturalistic moment at the very, very end too that hopefully I'll remember to talk about when we get there. But this is a very naturalistic episode, but it's also like it really balances the drama with the comedy because there's like, I know you asked for our favorite lines and I wrote three of them because I couldn't figure out which one I liked the most. So there's like these little really wonderful moments of comedy, but then there's like some very serious stuff, and not just with Margaret, but with Nurse Gaynor in particular is like a really heavy story that happens for like just a little bit of the episode. Mm-hmm. And yet there's also like really funny things happening too. It's almost like three different, I don't want to say three different episodes because it's clearly one story, but like they've managed to capture like all these different emotions in like a 22-minute like time frame, and it's amazing how they did it.
Yeah, they weave all these threads together quite well. So the next scene is in the nurse's tent, and they're all a little tipsy, and they're making fudge. And there's this, and Margaret comes in to give like their assignments for the next day or whatever. And it's so it's like the classic thing of, you know, you can't laugh because you're in church or something, or you're in somewhere serious. But of course, that just makes you laugh harder. And Margaret comes in and is in absolutely no mood for the nurse's tomfoolery. But she goes up to Lieutenant Baker, and she's like, you know, what is that you're making? And she's stirring something in the helmet and realizes that it's fudge. And she says, we won't know. And she's like, hold it until September. And you can tell like she's desperately trying not to laugh. And it's got some real tension to it. It really does. And then one of the other nurses, I think it's, which one is it? It's Nurse Gaynor, you just mentioned, says, why don't you guess? And we'll tell you if you're right. And it's like they are just poking her. And, you know, it's like as someone that, you know, deeply fears Margaret Houlihan, it's like, oh Lord, you're just like, you're really taking your life in your hands by doing this, but they can't help it because they've just, they're overtaxed. They're a little drunk, and they just, they have like kind of no F's left to give at this point.
Yeah, you know, there's some really interesting stuff. And I think this is the scene where Margaret's like, I can't tolerate your drinking, you know, and Gaynor, mm-hmm. and I'm paraphrasing, and Gaynor's like, you know, I drink to feel. And she talks about, I've been through like this, had three cardiac arrests and blah, blah, blah. And one of the things I love about this episode is that they do some cuts to Margaret, and you can see that she's affected by what this woman's saying, but then Houlihan takes over like the major, mm-hmm. and she has to like be the disciplinarian, which they give her these wonderful, just these moments where you just see her and she's kind of like, God, that's really horrible, but I'm Margaret Houlihan. And you can't do this in here. And so you can see kind of the internal struggle that she has, because I think she wants to reach out to the nurses and she doesn't feel like she can at the same time. And I love her acting in this is just extraordinary. And the woman who plays Gaynor is quite good too. I mean, all the actresses in this are great, but particularly this side story was really effective for me.
Yeah. She has the line about burn victims. She goes, I don't even get upset when I have to deal with burn victims who look like mummies. And she just says that very quietly. And, you know, she's saying, I just want to feel something. So that's a good time to mention the four actresses that play the nurses. We've got Linda Kelsey, who was a regular on Lou Grant and other shows like Day by Day. And she was on Murder, She Wrote. She plays Nurse Baker. Carol Locatell, which we just mentioned. She plays Nurse Gaynor. She was on shows like NYPD Blue and Shameless. And what's your favorite credit of hers, Amanda?
She plays Ethel in Friday the 13th Part 5. And she's got this – I couldn't believe it was the same actress when I looked at her. I was like, she looks familiar. But she's got this great line where, like, she thinks the cop's going to harass her. And I'm kind of paraphrasing again. But she kind of backs up and she says, I got a bomb on me, swear to you. And just – she's this, like, backwoods hillbilly type. And she's – amazing in it. She's amazing. I can't believe the same woman.
Yeah. Patricia Sturgis only had two credits this episode of MASH and one other show. And then Mary Jo Catlett, who only had one previous appearance on MASH, which was in The More I See You, again, which That's we right. talked about last year. And this is so the only there is one plot hole, which we will get to, and you referenced it earlier. But the one small part of this I find frustrating is that these four actresses, except for Mary Jo Catlett, who had one previous appearance, are all new to the show. Not only are they new to the show, they will never appear again. These are the only time we're going to see these four particular nurses, and the only time they're not going to come back. And I wonder why they didn't have Nurse Kelly be in this and have like Bobby Mitchell or something, although Bobby Mitchell, I guess, had left the show at this point. But like, it's weird to me that Nurse Kelly, Kelly Nakahara, who was hired to be kind of the one nurse face that you saw all the time, isn't that in on this episode? And I wonder, and I'm curious what you thought. Do you think it would have given the show a slight more resonance if it had been nurses that we had all seen before, or doesn't it matter?
I don't think it matters, only because I think a lot about all the times that Hawkeye is with a nurse, and it's often somebody you see once, you know, like, and I, or if I've seen her more than once, I don't remember her more than a couple episodes or something. And so for me, I thought about it because I did see that's something that people have talked about online. And I was like, well, I guess it doesn't make sense that I'm coming from this point of view because all of the main actors stay together. But I guess when I think of MASH units, I think of maybe people going back and forth between units because they're not meant to stay in the same place. So I wondered if like the background characters sometimes are going to all these other places and that's what's happening. But that wouldn't make sense because the core group is still sticking together. But I think that's what I just assumed. And it didn't seem to bother me, but I'm also not like a hardcore MASH fan. You know, where like you could probably name every actress that's been on the show, you know, and I'm just like, oh, that's the one that Hawkeye made out with, you know, in the first season or whatever. So for me, it felt like a lot of the nurses were kind of coming in and out already. And maybe that was just earlier, but I felt okay with it. Also, I liked all the actresses and they served their purpose for what they needed to do. So, I mean, on a dramatic sort of level, that I think it worked fine. So yeah, I don't think I had a problem with it, but I could see where people could.
Yeah, I would imagine if you were Kelly Nakahara, just as an actress, you're like, hey, why did you know? This would have been nice. I would have been able to sink my teeth into this. Now, this was early on, still early on. We're talking about season 5, but it's still early on where the nurses, again, outside of Nurse Kelly, were relatively anonymous, and it wasn't until later seasons where Enid Kent would come on as Nurse Bigelow and they had Judy Farrell would come on and they would be, in fact they both first appeared in Out of Sight, Out of Mind, which is just a couple episodes earlier, but it would take like another season and then they would kind of be on regularly as well. So I think MASH decided later on, all right, let's have the same ish four or five actresses playing the nurses and maybe give the show a little more consistency. But yeah, it doesn't bother me, but I wonder what would it have been like to see Nurse Kelly. Although at the same time, Nurse Kelly was so sweet I don't know if I could imagine her mouthing off to Margaret the way
that might be part of it. Whenever I think of her, I always think, I think you were talking about this episode that she gets where she talks about her cute little button nose.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even when she's angry, it's like, oh yeah, she does have a cute little button nose.
Right. Yeah. Maybe it wouldn't be right. And especially the level of to where this argument gets, where as Margaret is leaving the tent, she accuses one of the nurses from stealing from supply for using peroxide in her hair. And then Nurse Preston pipes up, is that one natural blonde to another? And Margaret says, my hair has always been this color. And then Baker says, you mean blonde with black roots? And they start giggling. And Margaret takes it very, I don't have black roots. And then Baker cranks it up a notch and says, all right, gray. And that just, it sends Margaret to the point where they actually get into like almost a fist fight. And I feel like I mentioned, you know, earlier this was written by Linda Bloodworth and directed by a woman. I feel like that is a portal into something that women, that insult is something that women understand in their bones, and to men, they don't. I understand empirically that's an insult because they're saying Margaret is really old and she's covering up her gray hair. No one wants to be accused of having gray hair. No one does. But I think that requires a woman to write and direct to really get at the core of it. I don't think a man would think to come up with that joke.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because also I made that comment about the menopause statement.
Right. And, yeah. The same thing. Right.
Yeah. And those stuck out to me because I was like, oh, those are things that I think a woman would think to write. You know, even the dialogue is very female centric. You know what I mean? Like you can tell it comes from a more feminine kind of source. I mean, if I could be so bold, and I didn't even know that Linda Bloodworth had written this, but it stuck out to me, those things. And I was like, oh gosh, that's so interesting. So yeah, I agree with you. I think that's pretty astute of you to say that.
I mean, this episode would, you know, to borrow a phrase from later, this episode would really pass the Bechdel test because it's women talking about their issues, not men. You know, they're not talking about Hawkeye or talking, you know what I mean? They're talking about their own interpersonal relationships. And just the fact that Margaret gets so mad that she literally almost physically strikes one of her nurses is startling. You know, you're like, wow, that's how mad Margaret has gotten. She's so buttoned down. She's so under control under every circumstance. And yet that is what we never even, I mean, she's hit Frank. But like she never even like punched Hawkeye, and yet that's how mad she got. And you're like, boy, Baker, you are just living on the edge there.
She's awesome. And by the way, she's got this great blue robe on that I'm just coveting. I need to find it. She's so good in this. So Linda Kelsey, I have seen it. I'm a huge Lou Grant fan, but I hadn't really seen anything, I think, prior to Lou Grant, and I haven't seen Day by Day. I think I recognized her. I watched that casually maybe, but she's so good in this, and it's totally different from Billy on Lou Grant, and it's really great to see her in this kind of role. She's tough in it, you know, and she's a lot of fun. All the nurses, they were so well cast. They're all really good in their parts.
Yeah, absolutely. Patricia Sturgis has really big eyes. So when she does that line about, you know, is that one natural blonde to another? It's got a real accusatory kind of tone to it because her eyes are just very big. So the next day we see Radar and he is typing a letter home and he's shirtless because he's talking about how hot it is and somebody broke into his paperweight, the snow globe paperweight that he had. And then a GI walks in and the GI is played by who, Amanda?
Gregory Harrison.
I can practically hear the cartoon hearts fluttering over your head as you say that.
Everywhere, yes.
So, of course, Gregory Harrison has a very direct connection to MASH history in that he played, what was his last name? Gonzo what?
Gates. Alonzo G. Gates, I think is his full name. And then right. Gonzo came from that, from his time in Vietnam.
He played, he was Dr. Gonzo Gates on Trapper John M.D., which, of course, the makers of Trapper John M.G. keep insisting was not a spinoff of MASH. It was a spinoff of MASH the movie. But okay, you know, whatever. That's the argument they needed to make legally.
It's not even that. It's like it's just a reboot of Medical Center with some MASHisms in there. You know what I mean?
But you particularly love Trapper John M.D. to the point you have a show about it.
I do a thing called the Trapcast, but it's so sporadic because I've just been so busy. So I only have a handful of episodes. And but a couple months ago, I won't go down this road, but my sister was very sick and I had to go out of town. And every night I came home from the hospital, I would watch a Trapper John at the hotel. And I ended up over the last few months, I think I've now watched almost every episode. And so it's a great show, but it's nothing like MASH. The first episode is borderline MASH, but after that, it's really just like Medical Center, and they have no connection at all, except that the main character is named Trapper John.
Right.
You know, everything else about the mythology has like been rearranged. But Dr. Gates, played by Gregory Harrison, I would say he's sort of the Hawkeye of the show.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't he have like, and he lived in a trailer or something in the parking lot?
He does. It's called The Titanic, and it's like a, well, I don't know what you call RV, and it's like, and that's, he's actually, they actually had like, they had to close the like free clinic down. So he opened it up in his RV, and I was like, I'm not real sure this is sanitary, Gonzo, but okay. So like, but he's like the hot young doctor who all the girls love, and he dates constantly. And at the same time, he's got this really high moral compass, and he's also this really dedicated, amazing surgeon. And they have a Winchester who's Dr. Riverside. Like, they have a lot of prototypes, but it's not nearly like the same show. It's because it's just so light. Like, this show has, and I don't want to diminish Trapper John, but it doesn't, it, when it gets heavy in a much different way. Like, it's nothing like this.
I watched it as a kid. I remember, partly because I just watched a lot of television anyway, but I can remember every once in a blue moon, they would reference Hawkeye or something. Yeah. Trapper would say, oh, you know, back in Korea, Hawkeye and I would get so excited because it was like, oh, they mentioned, you know, it was just, that's what you had to live with, everybody. When all you kids who live with your modern movie cinematic universes where you get 30 movies all lumped together and TV series, we had to live for like one reference every three seasons. Yeah, that's what you had to live off of if you cared about this stuff.
That's right. We loved it.
That's right. Has he been in, I mean, well, your love of Gregory Harrison, does it come just from Trapper John, or was he in other TV movies that you enjoyed him in?
He's a very good actor, but I guess I know him most as Gates. But we did a episode on my regular podcast for a TV movie he did called For Ladies Only, I think is the name of it, where he plays a male stripper. And, well, it's actually like a really good movie. And the thing about it that really stuck out to me is that the character played by Gregory Harrison is supposed to be a really bad actor, and he's in these acting classes, and there's just two or three scenes of him acting in the class, and he's not doing a great job. And you're like, you can tell he's a really good actor because he can play a bad actor. Like, he understands how to do it. And it's a really interesting performance. Now, I don't think Dan liked the movie as much. I think he got frustrated with the character, but I thought it was a pretty good, I think he even produced it or something. I thought it was pretty good. And I've seen him off and on in other things. And he was just recently on General Hospital playing a doctor, I think. But I genuinely think, I mean, he's very, very good looking, and I don't mind looking at him, but I also think that he's actually like a genuinely good actor. And he's great to see here too, because again, like Linda Kelsey, I had not seen him in anything, I don't think, prior to Trapper John. So this would be my introduction to him, I think, on this MASH.
And he continued, he's still working to this day. He was on, so he was a regular on Rizzoli and Isles, and then he's on a show called Chesapeake Stories, which I have no idea what that is, but he's been in like every episode. So, you know, he's out there, he's still working. So good for him.
He's great.
But so yeah, he shows up, and like I said, he's Tony, and he has come to visit Nurse Baker because they got married, but they basically just he had to go right back on the line, and Nurse Baker had to go right back to the 477th. So they never even had a chance to have a honeymoon, which leads to Hawkeye and BJ. Of course, you know, this is not really their episode until they concoct this ridiculous plan. And they do this whole bit where they do this is your life kind of riff, where they're, you know, setting up the story just to kind of surprise her a little. And it's very sweet. And I love, there's a great gag here where, you know, they're leading everything up to, you know, of course, because Baker doesn't know that Tony's there, and he's hiding under a cot. And then he's like, a restaurant in Seoul. And then he's like, you were sitting alone and you heard a voice say, and it's clearly the cue for Tony to say something, and he misses his cue. And I love that Hawkeye kicks the cot. You heard a voice say, and he yells. I just love that extra gag they threw in. And then of course he pops up, and then she's elated because, you know, she's getting to see her husband, and they get all smoochy together. And of course, Radar, you know, finds it all so wonderfully romantic and stuff. And they decide, well, what are we going to do here? How are we going to get a honeymoon, especially with Margaret looking like a hawk, watching like a hawk? And then Hawkeye and BJ decide to, okay, we're going to pull something. And I mentioned this in the previous episode, the Lieutenant Radar O'Reilly, in that, of course, with BJ, you didn't have as many plots that were Hawkeye and BJ pulling a scam. Like in the first three seasons with Hawkeye and Trapper, they were always pulling scams. They were pulling something to get one over on Frank or even on Henry or a general. Once, you know, once Hawkeye got a little older and BJ came in, they moved away from those stories. But right now, they're kind of going back to that a little. And it's sort of fun to see BJ participate in that, of like pulling a scam to, you know, to get one over on Margaret. Now, of course, typical of MASH, they're doing it all for the right reasons.
Right.
But it's still them being like kids and pulling the scam.
It's a really fun one too, I think. I never thought of that with BJ before, but yeah, it's there's a lot of cute interplay in the scenes with Hawkeye and BJ and Potter and Houlihan even.
Yeah. And then that leads to a scene where Hawkeye is battening down Margaret's tent because he says we have a soldier in there who maybe has the plague. Now, this is the one part of this plot that doesn't make any sense. Why, of all the tents, that you were going to put this fake bubonic plague soldier in, would you pick Margaret's? That would, in fact, be the last tent you would use. And the fact that there isn't even a single line thrown in where someone says, oh, we normally could use the VIP tent, but so-and-so is here. It's a great episode, and it doesn't like, it ruins it for me. That's ridiculous. But it, as a nerd, it always just made me say, why would they do that? Why?
Well, not even just that, but she said that she was like being kept. Did she tell them that she was being, she couldn't leave her quarters or she wasn't supposed to? So the fact, yes, that they would try to oust Margaret, who would probably just have stayed in her tent that night and gone to bed. Like, it just seems like even if they're not going to use a VIP tent, they could have asked anybody else. But I guess she's the only one with her own tent.
I guess. I mean, you would just think, like, put her in the there's got to be some other tent in the camp. I mean, kick Zale out of his tent for pizza. There's got to be something you could do. It's the only thing where I'm like, that's what, they just wouldn't do that. But okay, you know, there it is. Fine, we'll move on. So the next scene is in Potter's office where they're trying to, again, pull one over on him. There's a nice little visual touch by director Joan Darling where right in the foreground is a fan blowing, you know, cool air on them, which we never see really before. And that's, again, that's a great touch just to remind everybody it's really hot. And in fact, like we just said, Hawkeye makes reference to the fact that Margaret is the only one with her own tent. And she's, because she's single with good, and he says, with good reason, I might add. And she says, you may not add. And he's like, strike that. And he's, so him and BJ are desperately trying to pull a fast one over on Potter, which, you know, kind of morally they don't want to do because Potter's a good guy. You don't want to pull things over on Potter, but they also know he's just super smart. And, you know, like, you could see it on Harry Morgan's face or Potter's face that Hawkeye and BJ know that Potter isn't buying it. And Potter knows that they know he's buying it. And they're both kind of like mutually coming to this conclusion of like, all right, guys, I know you're pulling something. I'm going to go along with it because you're you, but let's not go too far with this.
Well, they're like, oh, we think he has, and I can't remember the word, but like shimmy shot.
Yeah, it's just the symbiosis.
Yeah, that's it. And Potter knows exactly what it is. Like, yep, exactly. And he's like, oh, you can only get that like in Egypt when you're,
yeah,
in
the Nile. Yeah, he says you can only get that by wading waist deep in the River Nile.
And you're like, oops.
Yeah, oops. Yeah, again, they're trying to pull it up on Potter and they can't do it. And again, it's just, it's the wonderful soft face that Harry Morgan had where he could be so firm and yet so sweet And again, Margaret, of course, is horrified that she's like, really, you're going to let him get away with, she even says, you're going to let him get away with whatever there is they're trying to get away with. So it's like, we're all acknowledging this is bullshit. We all know it. And, you know, and then of course, Potter throws a monkey wrench into it where he says, well, you're going to sleep with the nurses. And that is a problem across the board because of all the tents that she should not be in. It would be the nurses' tent. But of course, what other tent they're going to put her in? Because there's really probably no other women in the camp. So what are you going to do? So, yeah, all just for naught.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is kind of a strange twist of fate for her. But it works. It all gets you to where you need to go.
Yeah, it gets you to the act break, which is, again, that's the important thing. So when the show comes back and there's a scene with the three of the nurses in post-op as they're just kind of doing stuff and they talk about going over to see Tony, and she says, I'm not worried about getting a bath. And then there's a water shortage. That's another runner that of course everybody is so sweaty that there isn't hardly any water. And Nurse Preston says, we got a honeymoon present for you. It's a few drops of perfume, which will cover up the sweat and stuff like that. And again, this is one of those scenes that, again, not to be so reductive and say, oh yeah, no man could ever write this scene, but I don't think a male writer would think to write this kind of scene where it's women talking about stuff that they are dealing with so specifically. And of course, you know, most of the nurses aren't worried about sweating because who they have to be, you know, who are they there to like worry about? But this is the one moment that Nurse Baker is there for her husband. She wants to be attractive to him, and it's the worst possible set of circumstances.
Well, I mean, everything about it, when you think about it, they're making fudge, and they're like, the girl's dyeing her hair, and there's all these nice little touches in it that do feel like very feminine, you know, like mm-hmm. they're in a feminine space, and I really appreciate that, and I agree with you that nobody's saying that no man could ever do that, but there's very specifically this is a very female space, this episode, and you can feel it, and it's really nice, and it's a little different, you know, and I like it.
Yeah. Then these a couple of Korean children come in, and the nurses kind of make a big fuss over them. And then the minute Margaret comes in, they tell them to scat, and Margaret's like, you know, you didn't have to tell them to run away. I happen to like children. And again, something that we have seen with Margaret, but it's been scenes with Margaret where no one else is around. So it's almost like nobody knows. And, you know, there was the season 2 episode Kim, where the little Korean boy shows up with that and they think he's an orphan and Trapper wants to adopt him. And we see that Frank has no interest in this kid, but Margaret is reading him bedtime stories and reading him bedtime stories in Korean. And she's really cute with him. And it's like that's a soft side of Margaret that we as the audience have gotten to see, but hardly anybody has. So it's like she has that in her, but she doesn't want people to see it. And I kind of love her Loretta Swift line read where she talks about like how offended she is, where she's like, you know, you don't have to make them afraid of me. I happen to love children. And you could tell, again, she's really mad at the way they're treating her.
Yeah. If it like their response, it would, like I said, like she's got this, like the way she, you can see the softness and then like the major comes over. But like, and I was wondering, like, I was reading some of the comments about this episode and people were saying, well, she's a horrible person and no wonder why they got fed up. But there's parts of me that are team Margaret and there's parts of me that are team nurses in this episode as well, because I think that even though Loretta Swit's character has done herself no favors by some of the way she's responded to some of the people there, you can see in this episode, like that, like I said, that kind of struggle that she has with like, I want to be more open about things, but at the same time, I also have to keep things going. You know, I have to be a leader or whatever. I mean, she's sort of misinterpreted what leader means, but I guess, and you would know better than me, but I think is there's some backstory about her father, right? Being a real disciplinarian or her wanting to always please him and him kind of not really giving her the kudos that she deserves for everything she's done in life. And so that just overplays into this, you know?
Yeah, they would talk about that briefly here and there. And then in a season 9, off the top of my head, he shows up and we see that he is a real hard ass and nothing she does is good enough and things like that. So you're getting to see all that. And then later on, you know, Hawkeye and BJ try and talk Frank into romancing Margaret and he is absolutely not interested. There's a great joke about you know, when I see her crawling on her hands and knees across the tent, across the combat, you know what that'll mean? She ate in the mess tent? No, you know, there's that kind of rat-a-tat-tat kind of thing. And I, you know, again, I love that when Frank storms off and they realize that this plan of theirs is not going to work, BJ is sitting in a wheelchair. He's just, you know, he's just wheeling himself around. Hawkeye grabs the wheelchair, like, by the handle, pulls BJ towards him, and he just says, I think we crapped out. And there's something so wonderfully sweet about how bothered that they are, that they're not getting to do this nice thing for Nurse Baker, because Hawkeye and BJ don't have any real stake in that. I mean, yeah, they've lied to Potter about it, but generally they're just trying to do a nice thing. And I find stories like that to be very, like, very powerful if they're done right. Just a simple act of kindness, because as we see in the world, there's not a whole lot of that going around. And just seeing these guys kind of put their reputations on the line through Colonel Potter just to give Nurse Baker a nice evening is just really sweet.
Yeah, what I like about it is that I think Alan Alda played such a horn dog in the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. And then when you see him wanting to do something that doesn't involve, like, him having sex with the nurse or flirting mm-hmm. with her. And BJ, for me, it just comes from him being happily married and wanting to see other people be happily married. You know what I mean? Like, and so I think it does a lot in terms of Hawkeye to sort of maybe humanize him a little and kind of remove him from that, I got to get laid all the time thing that was happening.
Yeah, it's sweet. It's. I mean, Alan Alda was naturally heading there as he became a more of a creative force in the show. But I also think if you want to, you could say that's BJ's kind of leveling influence a little. You know,
that yeah, BJ absolutely.
BJ's kind of a, you know, he's not the horn dog. And so without having a wingman like that, he's kind of, he's getting a little more father-like kind of looking out for Nurse Baker, which again, it's really sweet. So then we go back to the nurse's tent. We see that Nurse Baker is in a negligee that Mary Jo, as they say, gave her. And she they talk about how great she looks in it. And she looks down at the chest part and says, I think it's a little big through here. And of course, Mary Jo Catlett says, well, I loaned you the gown. I can't loan you everything, which is that's a great gag. You know, it's like, okay, this really feels like, again, I hate to keep bringing this up because it's like a broken record, but this feels like real women talking.
Well, definitely real people who've bonded and who are friends. Like, you definitely feel the friendship between the four women pretty deeply, which I really appreciate too. Because, I watch a lot of like anthology shows and like one-off TV movies and stuff. And it's really hard to get yourself people to invest in one character that's just going to be there for an hour or half an hour. And they did a really good job of throwing these like new people in and building them up as real people by the end of the episode.
Yeah, absolutely. There's another great gag where she says, you don't think it's too much? I don't want to look over anxious. And Nurse Preston with those great big eyes goes, oh, he might like that, which is a great button. But it's also really, like, it's kind of weird. It's like, you don't want to appear over anxious. Well, what do you, it's your husband. What do you wear? Like, really? Of course. Like, of course he has that on his mind. What are you talking about? Like, why would you even be worried about that at all? Which is just thought was funny. So they all crawl into bed and they pretend to be asleep. By the time Margaret shows up. And again, it's another thing where the nurses think that they are being buttoned down. And yet it's Margaret perceives it as a slight because she's like, oh, you know, everybody's on bed. There's no bull session. And they're like, no, Major, early to bed, early to rise. No. And they think they're doing what Margaret wants, but Margaret is insulted because it's like inviting somebody over to your house and then saying the minute they show up, yeah, we're going to bed. Well, if you're the guest, you're like, what the hell just happened? You know, why is everybody going to bed when I just got here? And so it's another schism in their relationship when I don't think the nurses mean it to be that way.
I think there's just a lot of miscommunication on both sides, you know, and the one thing that I think makes me pull towards Margaret too is that she is alone. You know, and it's mm-hmm. so much easier to be snarky or to have these little quips when there's more than one of you. And so they have this little group that's very tight knit. And sometimes I feel like, she feels ganged up on. And I would feel like that too, whether I deserved it or not, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of aspects to this, but it's generally just people miscommunicating what they want, possibly because they think they're doing what the other person wants them to do, like you said, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of upsetting in that way, but like, I really feel for Margaret.
Yeah. Yeah. She's been pretty rough on them, but she could tell she's kind of willing to, you know, maybe put herself out there, and that she just kind of keeps getting more metaphorically slapped down. And it's like, you can see why they would really grate on you. So then Nurse Baker sneaks across the compound. In the MASH geography, they always act like, you know, because of obviously this is a set that's been built, and all the tents, like all television is scaled down. Like all the sets are built like some percentage smaller than they really are. And of course, you know, in the universe, she's crossing the compound and she runs across Klinger, and she has to bribe Klinger lend him her peasant blouse with the matching scarf, which he asks about. That way he can let her pass. But it's like she literally walks about 4 feet to get to the next tent.
That's right. That's right.
It's like, it's not that big of a trip. I don't know if you really need a watchman to guard a space that small. I think you could probably just have somebody sitting in a chair and looking at the whole unit, but you know, they have to act like she's walking some huge distance. It's like, good Lord, Mark could probably hear her tent over. She's so close.
That's right. It is very close. But I keep thinking that peasant blouse must be awesome because she has great taste in clothes.
Well, Klinger knew what they asked for. So then we get the scene where Nurse Baker goes into the tent, and again, I don't want to oversell this, but this is a scene with just these two actors, both guest actors, fairly rare, you know, for the show with 7 regulars. No regulars are in this scene. And the way Joan Darling directs it, there is, I'd say, a fair amount of palpable, I don't want to say sexual tension because that's kind of bad, but like there's some genuine heat put across by these two. Like it's a believable moment that these two are going to have this night together. And it's been something that it's not played for laughs. It's a genuine serious moment of like, these have been two people that have been separated for a long time and now they're getting together and it's a big deal.
Well, I mean, it is Gregory Harrison.
Well, there you go.
So it's like, you got your one chance to like make out with them. You're going to go for it. Actually, they're both beautiful people. I mean,
yes.
Like, and I do think they do have a lot of chemistry, and it's really sweet too. You know, for me, it felt really kind of romantic.
Yeah, it genuinely is. It's a really nice scene. And then I said that scene was not played for last, but then the next scene is where Radar shows up with a breakfast, which again, very sweet. He's like, he's a hand delivering breakfast in bed kind of thing. And he doesn't want to see anything because obviously this is the morning after the night before kind of deal. And he doesn't get the memo because Tony and Nurse Baker have to say goodbye to one another and they want to have this nice moment. And Radar doesn't think to leave the tent. And he just stands there and he says, take care of yourself, sweetheart. And he says, write me. And Nurse Baker's like, I will. And then Radar's like, we will. He gets all caught up in it. It's really cute that Radar just gets caught up in it. And then he finally leaves the tent and he just goes, gee, love is swell. It's really sweet.
He's a romantic.
He is. And also there's a beautiful touch there where if you look at the lighting on the compound outside the door when Radar opens it, it straight up looks like it's about 6 in the morning. Like the sun is just, it's very different lighting than you would typically see on a MASH episode where it's kind of just generic day. This looks like it's 5:30 in the morning, 6 in the morning, because obviously Nurse Baker has to get up and out and back in the tent before Margaret gets up. So there's a palpable feeling of, yeah, this is actually really early in the morning.
Yeah, I thought that too. When he was actually bringing the food, I remember thinking, wow, it seems a little light for what we just saw, the scene right before where they were kissing at night, but it can't be daytime because it's got this almost reddish color. And yeah, that was really well done.
Yeah. That's really, again, a nice touch. Again, I don't know if that was Joan Darling or the lighting director or any of the other geniuses that worked on the show. So then Nurse Baker comes back and she has to literally straddle Margaret to get back in her back in her cot. And there's almost, it's almost like a little creepy the way Margaret waits until Baker is in her cot and pretending to lay down before then she pops up and reveals that she's been awake the whole time. And it's so funny that Margaret could have just, you know, pulled the ripcord the minute Baker walked in, but she doesn't. She lets Baker crawl into the cot, and almost for one moment think, hey, I got away with it. And then she says, you know, good morning, Lieutenant. This time I'm going to throw the book at you. And it's Margaret kind of almost at her most sadistic that it's, you know.
I agree. Yeah, it was pretty evil. She's angry.
She's angry. It reminds me of the time I cut school and my parents didn't tell me that they knew I had cut school until several hours after I got home. And I had told a bunch of BS stories about what my day had been like. And they knew the whole time.
That happened to me. Yeah.
the next day, well, not the next day, later on in the day, wounded arrive and they reveal to Margaret that what's going on. They're like, you know, you didn't just meet. Because she thinks Baker just went and had some sort of like assignation. And they reveal, no, it's my husband. We haven't seen each other in 6 months. And Margaret is like, you know, well, I don't really care. Rules are rules and they can't be broken. And they try and, try and talk Margaret into, you know, calming down a little. And that leads to a scene that is, you know, inarguably one of Loretta Swit's best across the 11 seasons of the show. And it's a scene that showed up in every single greatest hits compilation of MASH, every best of. They had this scene where Margaret, you know, finally lets them know how much she has been hurt about this, where she says, you know, did you ever invite me to, you know, one of your little bull sessions? Did you ever? And then she has this amazing moment where she starts to get really upset. And then she stops herself and does that in-breath you do when you're trying to stop yourself from crying. And I mean, good Lord, if that is acting, you know, I mean, my God, Loretta Swit just killing it because it feels utterly real.
Yeah, it's a very emotional scene. And it's also very naturalistic, like the way it goes back and forth and the buildup and like the way they kind of start to understand her, like that epiphany that they have. It's just, and that's the way a lot of arguments go. Sometimes when you're so pent up and things explode like that, and then the other person or people in this case starts like, oh my God, we did this too, right? And mm-hmm. and I just love the way the back and forth goes because it's not just like this explosion with no response. There's like, I think it helps create the weight when they realize that they're part of the problem. You know?
Yeah.
And it's like so heavy inside her. And I think everybody's been like this, where like we've put a lot of stuff down inside of ourselves and then something happens. Sometimes it's not even related exactly to what's happening inside of you, but it just comes out that way. And it's so hard for me to watch that scene and not just feel like in the moment with her, you know?
Yeah.
It's so well done.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. And they say, you know, she's like, you didn't even invite me for a lousy cup of coffee. That's the big line from that, the lousy cup of coffee. And they say, well, we didn't think you'd accept. And then Margaret, we see that she kind of like pulls her tears back and straightens up. And she literally pulls her dog tags as like there's some sort of weird totem of strength or something. But she literally tugs at them and she just firms up and says, well, you were wrong, and walks out. And the nurses, there's a moment where the camera holds on the four nurses as they all look at each other with this reeling of like, oh, we really screwed up. So then now we've got to finish up this caper plot where Potter wants to know what happened to the guy with the bubonic plague. And of course, he's talking to Radar first, and Radar, not knowing anything about medicine, he's like, oh, yeah, he had typhoid. Typhoid? Yeah, it was just a 24-hour kind. And Potter's like, you know, what? And then Radar goes, ooh, I forgot. And he literally just runs out of the room.
I love that part.
I wish I could have gotten out of some meetings that way in my life of just going, ooh, I forgot. And then I just disappear. Just, or hopefully this won't come back to bite me in the ass. then Potter finds Hawkeye and BJ, and they realize that this is all a bunch of nonsense. Potter confronts Margaret and says, you know, obviously you and I were the victim of, as he puts it, devious shenanigans, which is, he says with all the wonderfully colonelly authority that he can muster. And in this moment, you know, Margaret has every right to completely throw the book at the nurses, but she chooses not to. And she says, it's an issue between me and my nurses, and we will settle it. And we've talked about this on previous episodes, you know, naturally, you know, you repeat some of these beats, but you can't help it. Potter, great manager, because a lot of micromanagers would get involved, but he trusts Margaret to the point where Margaret says, this is between me and my nurses. And Potter's like, that's the end of it. Okay, let's go to work. And it's like, that's a great boss. You know, he trusts Margaret to handle it the way she thinks it should be handled. That's great.
I never thought of it that way, but yeah, you're right. He does this kind of like, okay, it's settled. However it got settled, right?
And yeah. I don't need to get involved in everything. That's great. That's a great kind of thing. So then one of the nurses pops in with a newborn, and you know, she's you know, this character, the Carol Locatell, Nurse Gaynor. Yeah. She kind of had a little mini arc in that she's been talking about that she doesn't feel anything. She doesn't feel anything for the, as I said, the burn victims that look like mummies, but she's just delivered a baby. And she mentions that the baby came out breech, and she may have come into the world backward, but she landed on her feet, and she's sobbing. She's sobbing uncontrollably. And so, like, okay, Nurse Gaynor is finally feeling something again. So whatever she was going through, she's over it now too, because she is getting so emotionally wrapped up in something as simple as a birth.
Well, there's two things happening here, because when she says that line that I'm going to paraphrase now that you said, because I can never do it verbatim, but where she says it came out backwards, but she landed on her feet. She's looking at Margaret when she says that. Mm. And that she means it also for her, I think. And also when she's holding the baby and Margaret puts her hand on her arm. And then Hawkeye says something like, you're wasting water by crying because they're having this water shortage. And Margaret starts laughing, and it feels like such a natural laugh. Like it was almost an improvised line because she was crying. And there's a, you know, that weird thing where you start crying and somebody tries to say something funny to cheer you up, and you have this kind of funny laugh that's like really soft. She had it, you know, and I was like, wow, that just feels like that came out of the actress, you know, and not the character for me. And I loved it. It just feels like such a natural moment.
Yeah, it's really, really nice. So then that's the end of the main part of the episode. And then we get the little bumper where the nurses are back in their tent and they are cooking fudge. And Margaret comes in and she initially says, is that fudge? Or she says, is that what I think it is? And they say, no, Margaret, no, Major, it's fudge. And instead of throwing the book at them, she comes in and puts her finger in it and tastes it and says, that's really lousy. And or that's really bad. And they say, well, how about a lousy cup of coffee? And she says, I'd love it. Uh-huh. And that is the and they hand her the mug. And that's the end of the episode. And it's, you know, I mean, it's just a marvelous character piece for these four guest actresses. Plus, of course, Loretta Swit. You got a little bit thrown in with the other characters, you know, kind of a classic, you know, again, you know, plot, you know, a heist kind of thing or scam. But man, it just. Another gangbuster episode and already a gangbuster season.
Yeah, it's so good. I love this one. Like whenever, if you were to stop me on the street, like as a stranger, and just be like, quick, what's your favorite MASH episode? This would definitely be one of the first to pop in my head. I've always just loved it, but I feel very like close to Loretta Swit in some ways because of her life kind of kicked in the second act of her life. And I feel like that happened for me. And like, there's so many things about her that I feel like I relate to. And so whenever there's like a Margaret centric episode, it's going to be the one that I'm going to be drawn to, I think anyway.
Yeah. It's just an absolutely terrific show. So do you have a favorite line or joke from the episode?
Yeah, I have, of course, now I can't find my document. Yeah. I had like three, but so I guess I liked when they did the "This Is Your Life" thing, and they were reading the letter from her, like in third grade, and they said, "When I grow up, I want to be in the Korean War." I think that's my favorite one. It always makes me laugh.
Using the fly swatter as a microphone and stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I love that. Yeah, when I grow up, I want to be in the Korean War.
Yeah, and they almost say it like they're like it's a question. Like, this is really not, this doesn't make sense, you know? But they're going to say it anyway. And yeah, it's just a really funny line. But there's some really good one-liners in here. Like, if the good father got the plague, who'd give him last rites, is a really good one. And also when Radar says, oh, no, listen, I don't want to see your honeymoon, I thought was really cute too.
Describe the honeymoon just as an all-purpose meaning of dirty. I don't want to see anything that was on the honeymoon. Yeah, well, my favorite line is when Hawkeye and BJ are trying to BS their way past Colonel Potter, and they talk about that he's been quarantined, and Potter says, Hawkeye says, he's been quarantined, and Potter says, for what? And BJ goes, for 24 hours. And then Potter immediately goes, the disease! And like, the timing of that is split second perfect. It is just the rat-a-tat-tat of it. And, you know, again, we talked about this last season for the More I See You, where, you know, that's such a Hawkeye show, and yet I loved how much they gave BJ, you know, that great moment that they find moments to say, okay, this show's about this character, but let's throw in this for the... And so, again, this is not a Hawkeye and BJ episode. It's a Margaret episode. But they just allow that to have this great rat-a-tat-tat of just the way Potter... for 24 hours. He's so mad. Like, don't waste my time, BJ. What are you doing? I just think that is absolutely perfect. And so that leads us to something very special for this episode of MASHcast. As I mentioned, this episode is directed by Joan Darling. And when I was doing research for this episode, I remember thinking, there really weren't that many women directors doing MASH. Of course, 11 seasons. There were some, but not a lot. And I remember thinking, was she the first one? Because it's the first woman I can think of that directed a MASH episode. So I looked it up. In fact, she was. She was the first woman to ever direct an episode of MASH. So then I went and did my IMDBing, of course, and I went and looked up the career of Miss Darling. She was an actress. She appeared in a bunch of TV shows in the 60s and 70s. She was in a really fun movie with Raquel Welch called Kansas City Bomber, about roller derby, which I actually reviewed over on the Film and Water podcast with my pal Laura. But she's mostly a director. Her first credit ever as a TV director is for Mary Tyler Moore. First of all, imagine that. Your first credit is like the most popular show on television. And her first episode was Chuckles Bites the Dust, which is one of the most legendary episodes of television ever done.
Amazing.
I was like, I could not believe it. And so she went on to direct episodes of a show called Doc. She did one episode of Rhoda, a bunch of Mary Hartman's Phyllis, and then she went on to do this episode of MASH. And then she did other shows, something with a show called Stocker Channing and Just Friends, Taxi, aka Pablo. She directed an ABC two ABC after school specials.
Ooh.
Magnum PI, Civil Wars, Doogie Howser, Jack's Place, an amazing career. So I reached out to Miss Darling, and she could not have been nicer, and I actually got a chance to interview her about this episode. She was very happy to talk about it, and we talked for about a half hour talking about her career and specifically this episode. So now we are going to play my talk with Joan Darling, and Amanda and I are going to come back, and we're going to talk about what you're all about to hear, and then wrap up the show. But without further ado, here is my talk with director Joan Darling.
Hi, this is Mike Farrell, and you're listening to MASHcast.
Well, Joan, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about this episode of MASH, which everyone regards as really one of the best the show ever did, this episode. So how did you get the assignment to direct this episode?
Well, what had happened was there were no, quote, women directors going to work every day. You know, there were a couple of people who were women directors. Elaine May was working at that time, but there weren't no woman was just working as a director. And what happened to me was I wanted to be an actress and was building a successful career. And I went to Norman Lear with a project, and he said to me, how would you like to be a director?
I said, wow.
He said, well, that's what I think you really are. And he gave me a show called Mary Hartman.
Sure.
Which was an enormous success. And before Mary Hartman got on the air, then my agent sent the Mary Hartman pilots to Grant Tinker. And I got to do the show Chuckles the Clown, which was, again, another huge success.
Legendary episode.
And what happened was, I was right in that wave of it's time that we hire women and it's time that we hire Black people. So I just caught that wave, and also I was able to deliver the goods. I didn't know if I would be able to. And I actually had only planned to do Mary Hartman and then go back to acting. But when MGM called, I realized no woman was directing every day. And having two older brothers, I knew I would have no trouble leading a crew that week. So I think the reason why MASH came to me was they were very socially conscious and responsible people, all of them. And I think all of a sudden a woman director had appeared it was like I got heard about, and the work was good. And so Gene Reynolds, who was one of the great gentlemen of all time, they actually, I think they called and asked for me. And I know there was some mention of, do I think they gave me that show because I was a woman? And I have no idea whether that was part of it or not. And no idea.
I could imagine that they would think that a woman director would be great for this episode because it was Margaret-centric, and it was Margaret with the nurses-centric. It was so focused on those characters.
I would think so, and I think they were looking for an episode to hire me for because I had, you know, established a really good reputation. And I'll tell you, what was really lovely, Rob, about it was I went to – this was only – the second one camera show I ever did in my life.
Wow.
So and I went to follow Gene Reynolds around. He was directing the episode before mine, and I shadowed him, and I didn't know anything. You know, I mean, he said to me, we usually do 21 setups a day. I didn't know what a setup was. And I had no way that I was going to ask and reveal that. But the point was that in terms of the woman thing, was I was walking on the set with Gene and following me around, and the gentleman who was the sound mixer, which at that time they sat at a high table with a big box, and he, you know, big heavy guy who clearly been a crew, working on crews for 20, 30 years. As I walked by, he yelled out to me, "We're glad you're here."
Wow.
And that made me feel like, whether there had been discussion amongst the crew or not, at least there was some thought about, okay, here comes a woman director.
Wow, that's magnificent.
Isn't that a lovely story?
Yeah. Now I said, I know that you had directed the Chuckles Bites the Dust episode, which is a legendary episode. I mean, I had heard about it before I'd ever seen it. You know, it was just this famous episode. Was that a big calling card for you, or did the legendariness of that episode kind of grow in time? And so by the time MASH came around, it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that big of a calling card just yet.
Yeah. Well, what happened actually was a huge calling card because it was the first thing that went on the air with my name on it. Mary Hartman, even though it had been made before, didn't go on until after.
Gotcha.
Okay. But the New York Times headline the next morning was the funniest half hour ever on television.
So,
I think they had heard of it.
That's a positive review.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's astounding. Wow. Yeah. So you said that you had not known anything about direct. So you just learned it all on the go, like lenses and all that stuff? You just had to pick all that stuff up on the fly?
I've been an actress and I'd been on a series. So I knew the routine of the set and everything. Knew nothing about camera when I started. And very briefly, what happened was, Norman had given me the two pilots to Mary Hartman, took them home, read them, came back and said to him, look, I don't know if I can bring anybody else's concept to life. Now, I was been an acting teacher since I was 18. And I'd been an actress since I was 3 and told my father's business partners how to make scrambled eggs, which I'll be happy to tell you if you want to know. It's one of my more rehearsed performances. But what happened was I read the scripts and I came in and I said to Norman, I think this is not just a takeoff on a soap opera. I think this is how television is destroying America. This was the man who had four of the top 10 shows on the air at the time. And he looked at me and he said, well, I don't know if we wrote that up. If you could do it, that would be great. Now, he thought it was a throwaway show, Norman did. He thought it was a throwaway and that it would be on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon as a takeoff on a soap opera. That was his plan. So he gave me, we cast it together. It took us 8 weeks to cast it every single day. When, if there came a moment when he went ahead and hired somebody before we had had a chance either to read them or talk. And I said to him, look, this is the first time I know how to direct actors. That I know how to do, but, I don't know this person. Unless she would come in and read for me, I can't guarantee that I can deliver a performance. So he paid her off and put her in a later show in the season. Hmm. So he let me pick with him. Together, we picked the whole cast of it. And then he went away on vacation thinking this was just a little throwaway show. Left me alone with the cast for 2 weeks. Well, I was from New York theater. So I thought my job was to make these shows work. So I did things that, you know, you weren't supposed to do, that I didn't even know you weren't supposed to do. Like Louise Lasser was really the major spirit of that show. And she started showing me little rewrites she wanted to do, and I encouraged her. And we worked, you know, and all the cast had been chosen by me. And I, the way that I worked, I very rapidly kind of trained them into the kind of acting I like. And then Norman came back and loved the pilots, the theatrical presentation of the pilots, and somebody else was supposed to do the camera work. And that person came in and worked for a whole day. And I thought, this is the worst show. I'm just a failure. This is the wrong session for me. This just doesn't work. And at the end of the day, Norman came up to me and said, what do you think of this camera work? And I said, I don't know anything about it. I said, but either I just directed a terrible show, or this is camera work is really bad. He said, you're right, it is bad. He said, I want you to do it. I said, I don't know anything. This was a three-camera show. I don't know anything about it. And then I went, but if the way the first scene should be shot is you start with the three of them at the table, and then when she tells the joke, you go over to her, and then you come back to the to two of them, and then you go back. He said, you're doing it, and walked away. So he left me alone with his second in command behind me in the booth. And I was fond of saying at that time, because of the women's movement, I walked into that booth a woman and I walked out a man. I shot the whole show. And then when it was shot, Norman said to me, I want you to edit the show by yourself. He said, that's how you're really going to learn to be a director. Uh-huh. And he went away for 2 weeks and left me alone to edit the show. So he just gave me the playing field. And he was right about me, which I hadn't known, that I really am a director.
Wow. You know?
So that's how that had come about. It wasn't like I walked around being ambitious. I just wanted to be an actress, you know. And, you know, get the Academy Award and thank right. my stuff the usual. So
wow, he saw something in you that you didn't even see in you.
He knew that I was. He knew I had been. I was getting to be a pretty famous acting teacher while I was doing my own career. And who either went to my house with me for coaching, so he knew that about me. But I didn't know. I knew for myself as an actress, I have a very strong story sense. Mm. I know what a story is and when it's missing something like that. And I thought, well, that's the part I can deliver. I can deliver the story. But I actually have to come to I didn't hear this until later. When I got my first feature, Spielberg was a very old friend of mine and I had acted for him. And I called him up and I said, Steven, I'm going to direct a feature. What do I do? And the first thing he said was get a good pair of shoes. I said, is that what you want me to tell, you know, the archives? He said, and then he said the thing that unlocked the camera for me completely. He said, notice where you're standing when you're watching the rehearsal and put the camera there.
Ah, okay.
So I realized what the whole ball game was to take a picture of the story that I liked. And then I sort of knew how to edit it. I knew when I needed a two-shot. It just all dropped in one big penny for me.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was.
So I know from reading different books, a lot of the directors that worked on MASH said that it was a hard show to shoot because the sets were so kind of drab and cluttered and claustrophobic, and it was hard to light. Like, did you have any of that when you showed up to do it?
No, I didn't have that at all. The set seemed realistic to me. Mm-hmm. And since my brain wasn't to beautiful pictures, you know, my brain was to the story, and the sets looked completely appropriate to me for the story. And the sets for me were the places that the characters lived in. They weren't the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So whatever was logical behavior for them, that's what I was going to shoot.
All right, that makes sense.
When I thought about that, I said, that's a really odd thing. But, you know, a lot of people came from being wanting to be photographers, wanting to be cameramen, and moving on up to directors. So they were more conscious of it. Also, you know, the opening sequences of the helicopters landing, nothing could be more cinematic than that.
Mm-hmm.
And them running across the lawn. So after that, all you really need to do is tell the story.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. MASH was not a show that really was given to like directorial flourishes. So if that was something that you weren't interested in doing, then it's, you know, like you said, you just want to tell the story.
Right.
So it does, you know, you've got your sets, you just tell the story within those sets. So, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do want to ask you a little bit about working with the cast, because I'm always amazed, having not done anything like this, I'm always amazed that someone can come in, like a director who hasn't, like you in this specific instance, you hadn't worked with these people before, you hadn't been on MASH before, but you can so immediately kind of pick up on the rhythms of the show. And the specifically for this episode, I'm thinking about, you know, yeah, the whole show is about Margaret and the nurses and all that deep emotional stuff. But then there's that scene in Colonel Potter's office where Hawkeye and BJ are trying to bamboozle Potter, and they have the whole bit about he's quarantined. What's he quarantined for? About 24 hours. And then Potter's like, the disease. And it's such a like rat-a-tat-tat, Abbott and Costello kind of thing. And it makes me laugh every time I hear it. And it's like, if I had seen that episode and someone had asked me, who do you think directed this? I would say, oh, that's got to be one of the old hands, because it seems so lived in that it seems amazing to me that someone could come in fresh, never having directed MASH, and yet have the rhythms down so perfectly. So yeah, I want, you know, can you talk a little bit about what it was like working with Alan Alden, Harry Morgan, and everyone?
Well, I knew Alan to say hello to from New York.
Okay.
So, and Alan, of course, is probably one of the nicest people on the planet. You know, he's just an amazingly, really nice guy. And again, that set the tone. People like Gene Reynolds and Alan, that there was just a tone to that show of respect and desire to do good work and, you know, no nonsense. But see, I'm very impressed with that question, because there's something about the way I work and how that scene came about that you picked that out. It was really impressed me, because here's the deal. I'm very playful, even, you know, under the pressure of, oh my God, I'm directing MASH and I don't know what the hell I'm doing here, but I'm going to do it. I know what the story is. I'm very playful. And if there's anything I understand, it's acting. And I know how to talk to single actors and groups of actors. And I make a family of them very quickly. And they are, without my ever saying anything, they understand, because I'm an actress, I know the value of surprises. So I don't impose on the actors. I first see what they want to do. And then I start embroidering on what they want to do. Because I respect the acting process so much. And they'll come up with things that will absolutely knock your socks off if you leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a friend of mine once said he loved auditions because that was the only time you got to do the character before the director screwed it up. And I knew exactly what he meant. So I just wanted to get, so there was something coming from me, which is part of me and totally consciously sent out there. This is play. We're going to get this job done. We're going to be, you know, we're going to make the best story we can make, but it's going to be a good time. So, and that, I didn't have to talk about that at all to anybody. It's just in how I am. And once the actors discovered that they could really go off, not necessarily go off the script, but go off how the usual way of doing them all, then they start to blossom. So that was like, I think about the third day. And we were coming to the end of the day, and time was very precious on MASH because I shot first day on MASH, I shot 11 and a quarter pages.
Wow.
Which is also another funny story, because when they told me how many pages I was doing that day, I went, oh my God, this is impossible. But then, you know, dodo that I was, I went in and made the day. Then I heard two or three days later, I heard the AD talk about the pickup day. And I said, what's a pickup day? He said, that's when we do all the pages that we don't get. So I thought, okay. So anyway, it was the end of the day. Time was precious. The first rehearsal, I'm sitting back, and they know by now to just come in and do whatever they want. I want to just look at what they have to do. They started to laugh. They got silly. They couldn't, and then they apologized to me. And I said, no, don't worry about it. Let's just see what happens. Let's just see what happens. They tried it again. They laughed. They were falling on the floor. They couldn't say the lines. I didn't do anything to make it work. The biggest thing that I did was let them laugh. And they laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed, and then bing, got it.
That is amazing. That's...
And I also have a good instinct of when to start shooting, you know, so that I didn't say, well, we've got to do this, you know, and make sure, I want to make sure you know the lines. There was no panic in me about it. I knew I could get the scene in 10 minutes if I had to, quote, direct it. But I knew something was happening between them. And that's what I think you picked up on, the reality of being funny with each other, making each other laugh. Was so strong, that's what they'd been rehearsing. You know?
Yeah.
That's what the scene was about. That's what they'd been doing by breaking each other up and not being able to keep a straight face or get through the scene. So all I had to do was just wait till enough of it settled down, trust them, and then shoot it.
Amazing.
And that's why I was so impressed that you picked that out, that scene out. Because most directors don't work that way.
Yeah, I mean, having watched the MASH so specifically so many times over decades now, I've seen lots of other television. There's moments where I haven't done any of this kind of work, but there's moments where I can watch a scene on a TV show and I'd say, boy, that was pretty good, but it was just a little off or something. But I feel, and one of the reasons MASH is my favorite is I feel like their batting average for getting the most out of any given scene was off the charts good. You know, I think you can count on one hand over 250 episodes, the number of times where you say that could have used a little tweak, but that the nurses show, because it is so dramatic with all the stuff with Margaret and the nurses, and we'll get to that in a moment, but then you've got that scene, which is so different than everything else in the show. And it's so silly and yet it works. It's like, I could see, whoever directed this directed it and put it together in a way that absolutely gets the most out of this exchange, which, again, makes me laugh. I've seen it 1,000 times. I still laugh every time I hear them do it.
Well, I laugh just talking about it.
Yeah.
Because I'm sitting there watching them and they start, well, first they were very like, oh, gee, Joan, we're sorry, we'll get it right. I'm not. I'm like, well, I don't care what happens. Let's just, you know, see what happens. And I talk. Now, those were very good actors.
Sure,
I mean,
of course.
Really good actors. So there was not any underground teaching that I had to do with them. All I had to do with them was let them know I understood the process and that I thought we were supposed to be having fun, even in the serious scenes. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Yeah, completely.
What the point of what is the point of doing anything that difficult unless it's a good time? That was always my attitude. But they just, yeah, they were wonderful, wonderful actors. Mm-hmm. And also, with all due respect, their taste in directors was very good. You know, they brought in directors that could deliver a MASH show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely. So now you mentioned earlier working on the casting of Mary Hartman with those shows that you worked on. Right. Were you involved with the casting of this one? Because it's unusual in that the nurses that we see, three of the four of them had never been on the show before, and they would never be on the show again. They were brought in, and even the fourth one, Mary Jo Catlett, was only on one episode previous. So these, all four of those actresses were new to the show, right, as well as having a new director. So were you involved in picking those actresses?
No, not really. They picked them up. They pretty much presented them to me.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
So I could have said yes or no, I didn't sit in on casting sessions. The same thing was true over at MTM. I directed a bunch of other shows for them. Right. And I gave Michael O'Keefe one of his first jobs. And I gave Steve Martin one of his first jobs, an acting job on Mary Hartman. But the casting director brought him to me.
Gotcha.
And then I said, sure, you know.
Okay.
I can't wait to see him and tell him, you owe me.
It's a lot. It's a long career you helped to help launch her. That's fantastic. So, okay, that's interesting. So the big scene in The Nurses that everyone remembers is the final confrontation with Margaret and the nurses in the tent. When they did the clip show in season 7, they ran that clip. And any time there was like a retrospective on MASH or a reunion, they always show that clip of Margaret confronting the nurses. And there's this moment where Margaret is, you know, talking about, did you ever offer me a cup of coffee? Did you ever show me any friendship? And she starts to lose it. And then she catches herself. Like she does this. And I know that the hallmark of good acting is making things look spontaneous when, of course, they're not. And we know of MASH that you did not go off book. You
right.
In script. But can you remember how many takes that might have taken Loretta Swit to do? Because I can't imagine how she could have done that more than once. It seems so off the cuff.
Well, that's another incredibly insightful thing from you. And this is, again, my style. I knew Loretta socially. We used to play racquetball together.
Wow.
But we weren't best friends or anything. We hadn't played in quite a while. But I knew her. And Loretta is a really good actress. And what I mainly did was, I have to go back to my very first meeting with them. I asked them when I got the script, they always have a meeting with the director in case there's anything the director wants to talk about, possibly adding or subtracting. When I got the script, I went into their office and said, you know, I'm not really sure what is the precipitating incident to Margaret's breakdown. And they said, there is none. Mm. It's not meant to be traditional. It's the accumulation of heat of that. And as soon as they said that, I knew always to keep the actors, everybody in the show, aware of the fact it was hot. I kept that going in their minds. It was the heat. It was an accumulation of things that caused her to let go like that. We finally got to the day before we were going to shoot the scene. We, at the end of the day, we started to rehearse it, and we got halfway through it, and I stopped the rehearsal. And I said, we're not going to rehearse this. And I said to Loretta, you're ready. You are so ready. Go. I think Loretta talks about this on some interview show. She says, I think I did say, go home, take a bath. Don't think about it. It's there. I know it's there. We got it on the first take.
What? And that's it? That's the take that we see in the show? Wow.
But I have a very good instinct for that. I mean, that's one of my real, I think one of my real gifts is I can see what's happening with an actor, and I have almost an intuitive sense of what I can do to help it. And part of it was the staging. You know, she was really semi-deliberately by me, but knowing me as I do, I knew that my intuition told me that her blocking was incredibly awkward. She had to stand there with nothing to lean on, no sitting mm-hmm. down, no nothing. She just had to stand there.
Yeah.
And the work on the show affected her in a way she almost didn't know about. When it went, at the time, she was a little disconcerted by it. And I know the feeling as an actress. It was almost like, she might not say this, but it was almost like she didn't know if she'd made a fool of herself. Huh. Because it was so authentic. It was so deep. It was so much of who she was. And my job was to get her to the spot and make sure the camera's rolling when it happened. And the same thing was true in the Mary Tyler Moore show, the big laughing scene at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Right at the beginning, I took Mary aside and said, listen, I don't think we need to rehearse the funeral scene. I mean, the positions and stuff like that, but let's not bother acting it. I know you can do it, I said to her. You know you can do it. So I am going to set it up so that the dress show and the air show, you will be completely covered. And then if we don't get it, then we can, you know, we'll just do pickups later and work on the scene. But I said, I know you can do this. And that's a trance induction. I'm actually hypnotizing her into the fact that she can do it. You know, same thing with Loretta. I know it's there. And wow. I did know it was there. So it's like giving them my confidence to ride on. Mm-hmm. So Mary came in, we had blocked it, and she just kind of marked it. First show, she just blew it out of the water. Second show, blew it out of the water. What I conveyed to both of those women was trust. I trusted them as professionals, and I trusted them as human beings, and I also knew that if it didn't work for Mary, that we could, then it would take 15, 20 minutes with an actress like her to stage it after everybody went home and I would get the scene. But it was it was my trust. And same thing with Loretta, because I knew Loretta could do it. And I conveyed that to her, you know. And when she talked about doing that show, she talked about the fact that I came up to her and she's right. I took her hand, I held her hand at the end of the rehearsal day after I had stopped the rehearsal and said, the scene's ready. We'll shoot it tomorrow morning. I came up and I took her hand. And I said, you are ready. I said, go, obviously I said, I forgot this, go home and take a bath, you know, and relax and just come in tomorrow. It'll work.
Wow. That's extraordinary. That is, it must have been, you could hear like a pin drop on the set after she finished that, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. And I can't remember whether she wanted to do another take or not. I've done a performance like that on Defenders years and years and years ago, where the producer was so proud of it, called me up to come and see it. And I called my husband after I saw it. And I said, I can't tell. I said, I am either so good in this or I've made a total fool of myself.
because it's either one or the other.
Yes, one or the other. And I think Loretta felt somewhat the same way.
Wow.
This is the really great acting or I've, but you know, it's a big thing to happen to Hot Lips.
Yeah.
It's a huge thing that happened to her in that moment.
Yeah, it's a big turn for that character at that point. It really is. So, all right. So, wrapping up here, like, do you remember seeing the final edit? The final? Did you watch it at home when it aired, or were you off working on the next project? Do you remember seeing it and thinking, "Oh, yeah, wow, this really came out well"?
I loved it. I knew what I had when we finished shooting it.
Right.
you know, they edited all of their shows. You know, the director didn't really edit the shows
on the
episodic. But I knew it was. I knew it was. It brings tears to my eyes to think about that moment that Loretta went through, that the character went through. I knew it was good. I knew I was proud of it, you know. Oh, I got to tell you one other story, which is my first scene was 6 pages, 11 people. Now, this was the second one camera show I'd ever done. The first one we had regular sets and everybody knew where they were. And I how am I going to do this? So it was in the operating room. Mm. So I got a big piece of paper, and I was a football fan. So I sat down with this big piece of paper and I drew a football play where one character led you to the first conversation and led you to the second conversation. And then this second character led you to the third. So it was a constant moving shot, which... if I got it, then I only needed 3 very short close-ups and I had the whole scene.
Wow.
So I'm working away on it, at, you know, because it takes a long time to set up the timing of the camera move for it. The biggest thing to get is the master, because the story is going to be in the master. And I'm working away at it, and, you know, and the cameraman is delighted at being asked to do something that complicated. You know, he's having a ball. And I turn around and the whole brain trust of the show is sitting watching me. Gene Reynolds was there, Bert Nodella was there, a couple of other people I didn't know. And I thought, oh my God, I'm failing. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of, when I turned around and looked at them, they were laughing. Oh, they knew what I was doing more than I knew what I was doing. And I made the show within the allotted time to get that. I made the scene within the allotted time easily. But I literally called upon everything I learned from the Pittsburgh Steelers.
I would not have thought football would have come into an episode so much about Margaret and the nurses. That would have not have been something I would have assumed, but that's amazing. That really is amazing. Well, I mean, I just want to thank you for doing this and having this conversation with me. I mean, when I was doing the research for this episode and I knew that MASH had been obviously primarily male directed because there was just, as you're talking about, there weren't a lot of female directors back then. And I saw your name come up and I remember thinking, is she the first? And I saw, wow, you were the first female director. And, you know, this episode, The Nurses, is regarded by everybody as really one of their best. And it was the only MASH you ever did. And it's sort of like, you're like the Harper Lee of MASH. It's like you had the one at bat and you just... mixed metaphors, knocked it out of the park. I mean, just unbelievable. So thank you so much for doing this and having this conversation with me about the show. I'm just so thrilled to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. And I really, of course, it warms my heart that it's out there and being remembered, you know, and I was, you know, like I said, needless to say, it was separate from anybody's reaction. I was very proud of that show. I thought that show, the whole development of the love story between the nurse who's sneaking off with the husband.
Yep.
But I'm so used to, as an actress, going into my most honest self to understand what it is that's going to happen. You know, and you know, you probably know it as an interviewer. If you're authentic with me, I'm going to lose my self-consciousness and be authentic with you.
Well, it's wonderful again. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's just a complete honor to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for keeping everybody's mind on the fact that MASH existed.
Oh, it's out. It's a living, breathing thing. And a ton of young people are enjoying it. They're discovering it now. And that's just, you know, I feel like in some small way I'm contributing to that. And so, like I said, it's just being able to talk to anybody from the show, either before, in front of the camera, behind the camera, it's just amazing. So again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, Joan.
Okay, thanks, son.
All right, and that was my talk with Joan Darling. Amanda, you got to hear it, of course, before we sat to do this episode. I think you agree, utterly charming, utterly darling.
She lives up to her name. Yeah, she definitely lives up to her name. It was interesting because I know she talked a little bit about the lack of female directors. I think there were more female writers in the 70s that I can think of, but there were a couple of directors. And it's interesting that she talked about like doing Mary Hartman, which I think Norman Lear said he just thought was going to air on daytime. And when I say just, I'm not trying to diminish it, daytime television, but he thought it was going to be like this daytime set show or run in daytime programming. And the women who were working in directorial like kind of positions tended to work in daytime or very late at night, because the two examples I could think of off the top of my head are Lila Swift, who did a lot of the Dark Shadows episodes, and I think she might have done Ryan's Hope, and Gloria Monty, who of course would go on to become a producer on General Hospital, the producer on General Hospital, the most iconic producer they've ever had. But she directed, and Lila Swift did as well, episodes of the ABC Wide World Mysteries. And those came on late at night. And that show got a lot of press because it was one of the only series on television at the time that had a pretty sizable female crew behind the camera. And yeah, they had producers and story editors and things like that. And so, but it was very rare. And so she wasn't joking. And actually, Rita Lakin, who I almost mistook Lila Swift for, was a very prominent television writer. She wrote a book called The Only Woman in the Room, titled that because she would come into these rooms, writers' rooms, and she would be the only woman for like decades. And so I don't want to say she was lucky, because clearly she's really talented, but like she talks about when she got on the set and one of the crewmen said, "We're so glad you're here." And I know that Alan Alda was like a feminist, and I don't know how much push he had for wanting to have women come on the show, but he was doing the Lord's work, because it was really rare in the 70s to see anything like that, and especially on a show that big. And I'm sure there's other female directors I'm not thinking of, but those are the ones I mostly know. And I mean, that's literally three women out of how many directors they must have had in the 70s on television.
Right, how many episodes across how many shows, yeah.
Yeah, and so and to have her in prime time and to be on these iconic things is like beyond like imaginable. And so it's so cool. And it's great too that her recall of these things that she did is still so good, because like she remembers just little ins and outs of all the stuff she worked on. And that's great, because she, in your interview, she's documenting a lot of stuff about women working in film, you know? And so it's really fantastic.
Yeah, it was, I mean, again, her recall was amazing. And that story she tells about, we're glad you're here. What an amazing thing. And just how freeform television kind of was back then, that like, you know, Norman Lear could just be like, "All right, I'm hiring. I think you're, you know, I'm going to," or Gene Reynolds is like, "I think you're going to be a good director. Here you go. Here, direct the show. I'm going to go off for 2 weeks and do something else. Here, there's your show." Like, now, from what I understand how television is made, that does not happen. That just does, you know, there's so much more corporate control over things. And so, yeah, it was just such a delight and such an honor to talk to her. And I was so she was just so warm and giving with her time. And so I really, really thank her so much for talking with me. I said, it was just a delightful way to spend part of a Saturday afternoon, was just talking with this person and getting to talk MASH and stuff. So, it was so rewarding that I got to speak to her, because I was just so impressed with her work on this episode. So yeah, it's just really great to hear from her. So thank you, Mrs. Darling, for coming onto the show. So I think that is going to do it for this episode of MASHcast. Amanda, once again, it is always a pleasure talking with you. And so thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so excited that I got to talk about this episode in particular, because it has a lot of weight for me, and I carry it with me everywhere, you know, because I feel, like I said, I feel very close to Loretta Swit, the actress, and it's just such a great episode. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Sure. I guess the Made for TV Mayhem will be your keyword, because you can go on Facebook and look up Made for TV Mayhem. You can follow me on Twitter at Made for TV Mayhem, or you can follow my Instagram at Made for TV Mayhem. And that's where all the stuff, like my podcast, which is obviously called Made for TV Mayhem, can be found. And anything else I do, like if I'm working on a Blu-ray release or something like that, I'll announce it there.
Very cool. There's, if you want to have a whole collection of Amanda Reyes Blu-rays, you can do that. I have a little section. We installed a video store in our apartment in the corner and little shelves, and I have my Amanda Reyes section.
Wow.
All your commentaries. It's right after the Universal Monsters is the I got the Spell and Pray for the Wildcats, a couple other ones. So yeah, you too can amass the, it's like Criterion. You just put numbers on the top. Make a whole
thank you.
So, of course, everybody, you can follow this show over on our website, groundwaterpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at MASH4077cast. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Muscle Burbage, Dan Peel, Brett Tram, Mike Thomas, Michael Porter, Joe Perino, and Billy Shulman for their support of MASHcast. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
Mickey Baker, this is your life.
Hawkeye.
Out of minutes of exhaustive research comes a remarkably dull story, starting with your birth somewhere in the U.S. of A.
Radar.
Shortly thereafter, because of a keen mind and body to match, you were allowed to skip infancy and go directly to the third grade, where you were heard to say...
When I grow up, I want to be in the Korean War.